Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
And thank you very much, Dr. Parsi, for coming here. As someone who's done a little bit of diplomacy myself, I think you did an excellent job of portraying the fog of diplomacy. Military people use the term fog of war because of the uncertainty of understanding what's going on in a battlefield. Histories make very clear something that isn't clear at all to the soldiers that are engaged in combat. And so it is also in diplomacy. The fog, there's lots of moving pieces, lots of moving issues, lots of interests, some of which may be more important here, some less important there. And I think what you've done, Dr. Parsi, to kind of lay out some of those complexities and alternate sides of the history as it unfolded, I think was very helpful for all of us. Our staff is passing around question cards, and I hope you'll take a moment and pen some questions, and we'll get to those in a moment. And I'll start out the conversation with a couple of my own. One of the aspects of U.S.-Iran relations that you've more or less highlighted, it refers to something that I perceived in our diplomacy as well, which was that it was very, very focused on one thing, which is to say Iran's nuclear ambitions. The Bush administration, in which I served, very focused on that problem. Initially, in the first several years, overwhelmingly focused on pressure. There was an effort in the late Bush years to try to open some channels and make use of the P5 plus Germany exercise, but it was all nuclear, nuclear, nuclear. The Obama administration's approach as to restate what you've described in a somewhat different way, put the nuclear issue as on a kind of a pedestal. This problem is so big, it is so compelling for American interests for a variety of the reasons you've laid out, that in effect we're going to set aside the other aspects of U.S.-Iranian relations, other concerns that the United States has about Iran's behavior in the region and the ways in which it operates in the region and in other areas of the world in ways deeply inimical to American interests, we're gonna set that aside. And we're gonna try to solve this problem. And the Obama administration did as you've described. Was that the right strategy? Did that make sense? I mean, and in a sense, the fact that we are where we are now kind of illustrates that it maybe wasn't. Iran, contrary to some of the expressions of hope by especially Secretary Kerry, President Obama was generally a little bit more moderate on this. It talked about the opening that the nuclear deal would open a new page in our relations and change a confrontational relationship into something else, and that didn't happen. And it didn't happen maybe in part because of things we did, but also because Iran's behavior didn't change. So my question to you, first question I want to pose, was that the right strategy? Or was it always kind of mistaken to begin with?
I think it's a great question because it really goes to some of the criticism that has existed in the past that, well, it didn't address these other issues that the U.S. has problems with Iranian policy, and vice versa. The Iranians would also come in with a big list of things that they would like to see changed. I think, there's two components to this. First is that because the Israelis for two decades had pushed the idea that Iran's nuclear program is an existential threat means that's the priority. An existential threat is a threat above all other threats. But even if that's the case, and even if that is what the administrations, both Bush and Obama, accepted, it did not necessarily need to mean that diplomacy would only focus on that issue. The reason why that happened is partly because there was pressure from US allies. The Israelis only wanted us to focus on the nuclear issue for their own reasons. The Saudis were terrified of the idea that the United States and Iran would talk about regional issues without the Saudis being in the room. Not something they wanted to see. But there were also practical reasons, and those were that the belief was that in order to get a deal, we need to have a united P5 plus one. The only issue the P5 plus one could agree on was the nuclear issue. If you had included regional issues, certainly the Chinese and the Russians are closer to Iran on Syria than they are of the United States. If you had included human rights, I'm sure the Chinese would not be particularly helpful addressing human rights in Iran. So in order to get unity, you had to narrow it down. But I think it's still, your conclusion, in my view, is still valid, because there may have been the strategy that maximized the likelihood of getting a deal, but unfortunately minimized the likelihood of making it survive.
So the second question I want to ask, we are where we are. The president has withdrawn the United States from the deal. The United States now moving to put pressure on the Europeans to revert back to the zero purchases of Iranian crude oil that pertained for a certain period and deprive the, one report I read a couple of years ago was depriving the Iranians on the order of $5 to $6 billion in revenue a month. A shortfall of revenue that really kind of got the attention of Iranian leaders. And I assume we will accompany that with efforts with other buyers, with China, with India, Southeast Asia, Africa, elsewhere, potential buyers of Iranian product. The Iranians reacting in perhaps some of the predictable ways. So in the fog of diplomacy, as one looks ahead now, and you refer to this to a limited extent in your prepared remarks, but what should be the approach of the United States? And I'd ask you to accept as a given the decision the president has made. What are going to be the combination of strategies and tactics for the United States to pursue? How, what kinds of influence can we bring to bear? What leverage do we have with the Iranians? And how can we get a deal that addresses the nuclear problem adequately and at least gets at some of the broader problems that are very real and very important in U.S. foreign policy as it pertains to Iran?
I know the premise of your question is that I have to accept the decision the president has made, but I'll be frank, I don't think he has a chance unless he undoes that decision. The idea that we can achieve a better deal, that we can address some of these other issues by going down this current path, the administration is now asking all countries to end all of their purchases of Iranian oil. Oil prices went up 3% today around that news. And the spare capacity does not exist in order to be able to stabilize oil prices if you take all of Iranian oil off the market. You have country, and beyond this, we have to take a step back and remember, no country likes to hear a diktat from the United States on what it can and cannot purchase. And whereas some countries may not have the leverage to be able to resist, countries such as China and others, who are big purchasers of Iranian oil, certainly do have that ability to resist. And as a result, this policy will not end up becoming as effective and successful. Remember, for the Obama administration to get that buy-in, it's not just that initial decision. It's to also to stick with that decision. Because sanctions, oftentimes, if you really want to get the bite, it's not going to be the immediate bite. It's going to come over time. And even under the Obama deal administration, they were very worried about what they called leakage, that countries that were officially abiding by the sanctions underneath the table were still making deals, et cetera. So getting And that was countries that nevertheless were persuaded to do this. They were not strong-armed to do this. If we're going to strong-arm countries and then expect that they will stick to this, well, they're actually taking huge losses. One Asian diplomat told me yesterday that his country is going to have a very hard time accepting this because they have refineries that are specifically built for the type of oil that is coming out of, that Iran is exporting, mindful of the sulfur concentration, et cetera, et cetera. He said they're all going to go out of business if there's no purchase of Iranian oil. So we're asking these countries to make huge losses, but for what? For a better deal? The existing deal from their perspective worked. The only countries in the world that believed this deal was a bad deal was the United States, as it was Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the UAE. Everyone else is behind this deal. This is a deal that got adopted by the UN Security Council with 15-0 votes. How are you going to convince these countries to take these massive economic hits for something that we broke deliberately? I think it's going to be very, very tough. And even for those who end up abiding by it, they're going to abide by it with a lot of anger and frustration. And in the long run, I think it's going to end up being very problematic for the United States, particularly if we then also utilize the international financial systems as our own national instrument of power. We're creating incentive for other countries to create their own financial systems, which will then cause the United States to lose a lot of leverage over time. If you had a scenario in which the Iranians had actually broken the agreement and they were cheating and there were evidence of that, this would be a profoundly different scenario. And I think there would be several countries that would be quite eager to collaborate with the Trump administration on it. But that's not the scenario that we're facing right now. So going back to, okay, what should be done? You mentioned in your earlier question that there was hope that behavior or policies on the Iranian side would change. Well, we have to remember this. The deal was only 2 years old, or essentially 1 year old, when Obama left office. The idea that over the course of 1 year everything would change is very unrealistic, and that was not the expectation of the Obama administration. They were hoping that by the time the deal essentially expired, 10 to 15 years from now, there would have been a very different incentive structure for Iran, and that would have caused the Iranians to pursue different policies, not on year one, but by year 10 or by year 15. But there also begs the other question. What policies of the United States changed as a result of the nuclear deal? Did the United States sell less weapons to Saudi Arabia? No, we actually sold more. Did the United States not support Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen? No, on the contrary. Under Obama, they started supporting it. These are concerns that the Iranians are having. So the deal, when it comes to how we measure whether it was successful or not, has to be measured by the indicators of the deal itself. And those indicators were, will the Iranians reduce their stockpile of low-enriched uranium? Will they close down all their nuclear sites except Fordo? Will they ship out 97% of their LEU? Will they make sure that they don't do anything that can be used for military purposes? Those were the indicators. And on those indicators, they did everything according to the IAEA that they should have. Unfortunately, under Trump, the sanctions relief stopped on day one. He didn't walk out of the deal until May, but from the very first day that he came into office, he signaled, I'm not sure if I'm going to keep this deal. I may do it, I may not. What does that uncertainty do if you're a business seeking to potentially enter the Iranian market? Uncertainty is a de facto sanction. If you have uncertainty, you're just going to stay away. You're not going to go in there and then end up being sanctioned by the US Treasury. So by deliberately infusing this sanction, he was already breaking that agreement from the day one that he came into office.
I've got a large stack of very good questions, and I want to turn to those. Several of them deal with a question that I had, and that is to ask you to talk a little bit about the internal dynamics in Iran and how those dynamics relate to Iran's nuclear ambitions, its regional ambitions, Iran's inability sensibly to deal with the United States, because the dysfunction works in a couple of different directions. It seems to me, looking back on the ebb and flow of Iran throughout my professional life, I joined the Foreign Service in 1979, the year colleagues and friends of mine were taken hostage. You have a large cadre of now very elderly clerics, who have essentially largely monopolized power for themselves. They're getting old. attempting to cling to power, sharing it to some extent with elected authorities, but kind of not in some important ways. You have a dynamic society, young, well-educated people interested in being part of the world, an economy that is got all kinds of problems, to some extent induced by sanctions, to some extent induced by corruption, mismanagement, bad investment decisions, and the like. Lots of pressures going on. Talk about that internal dynamic and how it relates to what Iran is up to in the region and the nuclear peace.
So if we start off with what you mentioned, it is a young but nevertheless aging, it's not as young as it was 10 years ago when everyone said half of the population is under 30, now they're under 40. but this is actually important because the demands that they have is a little bit different from what a very large segment of society that are 20-year-olds. But it is a very dynamic society, it's a very well-educated public, and one that is absolutely, there's such dismay that they're so isolated. They so yearn to be connected with the outside world. The idea of Iran being isolated is a complete anomaly for Iran's history for the last 3,000 years. And they want to connect with the outside world, and particularly with the United States. This is part of the reason why the nuclear deal, when it was struck, was overwhelmingly supported by the public. And you could see Rouhani's popularity figures and Javad Zarif's popularity figures go through the roof, because they really wanted to end this isolation, break out of this isolation. There is, as much as there is a strong anti-American sentiment amongst hardliners in Iran, the population in general tends to have very positive sentiments towards the American people, towards the American culture, American values. They don't sense any deep sense of animosity to the US. They're critics of US foreign policy. And this is an important point to differentiate. It's not as if they're fans of US foreign policy, but they're also not fans of their own country's foreign policy. So they can differentiate a country from its government and its foreign policy. They are now deeply frustrated because they were hoping that this deal would actually lead to a better economic situation, lead to greater connectivity with the outside world. And you're quite right when it comes to the economic situation. The main problems at the end of the day are mismanagement, corruption, which is just through the roof. You have the IRGC that essentially is functioning as a mafia inside of Iran. And those things, incidentally, make sanctions more effective. A more properly run economy would be more resilient against those type of external pressures. The outlook right now inside of Iran is very, very grim. The confidence in the idea that the economy can move in the right direction, lead to a more open and more connected Iran. Also the idea that the domestic reform that many people had hoped Rouhani would undertake, that he's only done to a certain extent. If you had a very optimistic population 3 years ago, today it's shifted quite dramatically. And that is very much a connection with what has happened with the United States and the nuclear deal. I used to be very, very hopeful about Iran. And I am still hopeful in the long run because the society itself is so dynamic. If you compare it to other societies in the region, you have in many cases in the region countries in which if their autocratic leaders were to be overthrown, there's a high risk that the society would produce an even more autocratic and radical leadership. Iran is the big exception, in the sense that the society is light years ahead of the government when it comes to values. Having said that, it doesn't mean that if there's regime change today, tomorrow there would be a democracy in Iran. But when you take a look at where the pressure for democratization is coming from, that actually is effective, it's from the Iranian society itself. Take a look at what happens at the city council elections in Iran. They coincide with the presidential elections. But the city council elections are different in the sense that the Iranian Guardian Council, this highly undemocratic element in their system that is vetting candidates and making sure that certain people cannot run, they do so for presidential elections, they do so for parliamentary elections, but they don't have the legality or the capacity to do so for city councils. In the last election last year, reformists won all of the seats in the major cities. The number of women who won seats on these councils quadrupled compared to the previous elections. In the city of Mashhad, which is a very conservative city, I hope I'm not insulting any Mashhadis in the audience, a woman ran on a platform of opposing the patriarchy. Her slogan was, elect more women. She won. So we miss these things because these things are not often ever reported in our media here because of a lack of interest. But these are things that are happening inside. But for those things to continue to happen, it's very critical that tensions between Iran and the outside world, particularly the United States, lessen, not increase. When they increase, the immediate victim of that is the pro-democracy forces inside of the country.
You referred to reformists doing very well in the election.
Yes, I didn't say moderates. These were not.
What kinds of reforms are they promoting that are popular, or that win that popularity?
Well, they're pursuing, they want to see much greater social freedoms. They're not pursuing the same type of a very strict conservative interpretation of Islam. They want a very different relationship with the outside world. That is something that they have been running for quite some time. And in general, the criticism, of course, is that they're not pushing hard enough and they're going slow about it. But they do have a very different vision about the direction and how the Iranian society should be looking. And their constituency tends to be the middle class and the upper middle class. When we talk about the Green Movement in 2009, that's clearly the core constituency. They tend to be in the cities. If you take a look at the protest, very widespread protest that took place in December of last year, that was a very different segment of society. That was the working class, had not been at the center of Iran's political development for the last 20 years. Not at all the same political experience and organization. I spoke to several people who were organizers of the Green Movement in 2009. They had no clue what was going on. They said, we don't know who these people are. We sympathize with their grievances because we share them, but we don't have any familiarity because they didn't come out of any organization or anything like that.
Here, let me follow up with a question, specific question that came from the audience. What are the likely impacts of America's abrogation of the JCPOA on the eventual selection of Iran's next supreme leader?
So the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has probably been the most reluctant supporter of diplomacy. I mean, essentially, he's been quite opposed to the idea of diplomacy with the United States. He approved the secret channel. He did so because of the convincing of the then foreign minister, Salehi. But he constantly took the public position of saying, I will allow you to go ahead with these negotiations. You know our red lines, but mark my words, you cannot trust the United States. The U.S. will end up betraying this deal. And what it reflected was a debate that existed inside of Iran. And I'm going to simplify it very much. Those who said, look, the problem with the West, Iran also has been at fault, has done a lot of unnecessary and dumb things that have made it worse. But we can reach an agreement if there is compromise from both sides. And there's a value in pursuing diplomacy for that. And then you had the hardline narrative that said, no, the United States is inherently opposed to Iran. It's not just a system, but it's Iran's power and position in the region. And pursuing diplomacy ultimately will not work because the U.S. will never accept Iran as a power in the region. 2015, it looked as if the moderate narrative had won out. 2018, Khamenei now feels that he's been vindicated. And with that comes an implication of who the next supreme leader would be. Part of the reason why the hardline media in Iran have been reporting very generously about protest in Iran. And actually, hardliners in the city of Mashhad initiated the 2009 protests is because they want to show that Rouhani has lost control. They're even pushing now, making suggestions that he should be stepping down as president. And they're pressuring Khamenei to approve that. And part of the reason for this is not that they're fearing that he as a lame duck would do a lot. It's because they want to eliminate him from having the chance of becoming the next supreme leader. That's what the big fight internally and inside Iran is right now. Everyone is positioning themselves to see who will come and take over after Khamenei.
And what's the timeline for that? I
mean, that depends on when he dies. I'm not a doctor, but
is this months or a couple of years, or is that long?
Well, there's people in D.C. who have predicted that he would die almost every month for the last 10 years.
He's hanging in there.
They've been wrong for 10 years, but at some point they're going to be right. He is 78, if I'm not mistaken. He does suffer from prostate cancer. For an Ayatollah, that's still pretty young.
It's a cheerful thought. Okay, there are several questions that focus on the region, Iran in the region, and American Western interests in the region. One writer notes there are many topics in the Middle East that would demand Iranian cooperation with the West, issues where the imperatives actually push both sides to want or at least need to cooperate with one another. But what are the broader implications of Iran's, for those imperatives, of the of Iran's support for insurgent groups in Syria and Yemen, particularly given that this support provides fuel for American criticism of Iranian actions? You could add to that Iran's relations with the Saudis, Iran's engagement in Afghanistan, and then there's a sidebar. Could you talk about Iranian soft power and hard power in the region? How Iran uses its hard power, its soft power, as it looks at and deals with its problems in the region from its point of view?
As a result of Iran's involvement in Syria, Iran's soft power in much of the Arab world right now is more or less non-existent. This has been, beyond the fact that one could criticize it from a moral perspective, but this has been very, very costly for the Iranians. And there's been an immense amount of criticism of it as well, particularly from the reformist side, who have opposed the idea of supporting Assad. That criticism, however, has ended up being much more muted after 2014. Because 2014, when ISIS took Mosul, and how they were executing and killing Shias, the argument of the more hardline elements saying, this is the same thing that is happening in Syria, and you have to defeat them, and the frame that Assad is fighting terrorists, not fighting an opposition that wants a different political system or greater freedoms, started to win out. And you could see that the support, even amongst the public, according to several polls, increased for Iran's involvement, precisely because the Iranians were fighting ISIS in Iraq, and then saying that it's the same fight in Syria. But overall, I would say that the Iranian public tends to, like many other countries, have a little bit of an isolationist streak. They don't understand what the value is of being involved in Lebanon and Syria and Yemen, etc. There's so many problems inside of Iran. It's much better to utilize the resources for these things, which is not particularly different from what I'm sure you saw in Turkey and many other places as well. The problem, though, is, at the end of the day, that in the absence, as I talked about earlier in the talk, in the absence of some form of an order, some form of a security architecture in the region, this will not end. And big powers will be sucked in. We talk a lot in DC, a lot of people saying that, critics of the deal say that Iran's policies after the deal became more aggressive. I don't see any evidence for that. Iran's involvement in Syria did not increase or decrease as a result of this. It's fighting ISIS happened in 2014 before the deal was struck. What has happened is that after the invasion of Iraq and after the Arab Spring, which incidentally are also linked, almost every country has ended up having a much more activist, interventionist foreign policy in the region. Take a look at Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia used to have a very subtle, behind-the-scenes diplomacy. You hardly ever knew what they were really looking for. They used Egyptian diplomats to actually do most of their bidding. And what is Saudi Arabia doing now? They have a 4-year invasion of Yemen. They have a blockade against Qatar. They kidnapped the Lebanese prime minister. I don't know what category to put that type of an act in. I don't think anyone else has done that. This is dramatically different from what you see Saudi Arabia do in the past. Take a look at Turkey, where you were ambassador. Erdogan was talking about a no-tensions policy. Now he has tensions with every neighbor and is activist in many different scenarios. This goes back to what I said earlier on. In the absence of a security architecture, you're going to have powers that have the capacity feeling sucked into all of the different vacuums that are being created. The only solution for this is not to go down and say, well, all of this is Israel's fault, or all of this is Iran's fault, or all of this is Saudi Arabia's fault. The solution to this is to actually create a new security architecture through a diplomatic avenue. It will take time, but it will be far less costly than what the current strategies are, and make sure that all of the major powers are at the table. At the Geneva conference that existed in the past to deal with the Syrian situation, immediately after the JCPOA was struck and the U.S. ended its containment policy of Iran, the U.S. shifted 180 degrees. Prior to that, it had pushed for Iran not to be at the table because the containment policy meant that we would not like to see the Iranians at the table. After that, the U.S. position was that Iran has to be at the table. Obama even had to call the king of Saudi Arabia and tell him, don't you dare call in sick. Because the Saudis were threatening not to show up if the Iranians showed up. But they did show up. And it was the first time since 1979 that you had the Russians, the Americans, the Saudis, and the Iranians all at the table at the same time. That's what we needed to invest in. That's what we needed to pursue in order to be able to resolve these problems. Arming this group, arming that group. I mean, where has that led to? Just more fighting and this civil war. Most civil wars, actually, unless there's foreign intervention, tend to end within 12 months because there's simply not enough weapons and ammunition to continue it. This has been going on for 5 years because of foreign powers intervening. Iran, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the United States. French soldiers are in Yemen right now fighting with the Saudi coalition. And incidentally, I just want to say this because I think we have to be a little bit, we have to look at what our own actions are also doing. The Swedes, my former boss at the UN mission when I was an intern there, who's now the ambassador of Sweden to the UN, introduced a resolution just 2 weeks ago calling for a ceasefire in Yemen to avoid this assault on the port city of Hodeidah where 170,000 children are trapped. Well, guess what countries vetoed that resolution? The United States and the United Kingdom. This is not helpful.
There's several questions that ask you to speak a little bit about what may happen. Is Iran going to successfully develop a nuclear weapon? What will happen if it does that and successfully tests it? What then is the likelihood of conflict, of war, and how do you see that playing out? Would Israel bomb Iran's facilities in order to try to forestall this step forward by the Iranian regime? It's a basket of things, if you could try to...
So I certainly hope that they don't go down that path. I am worried that the likelihood of that has increased significantly as a result of Trump walking out of this, and particularly Trump walking out of this and then having a successful handshake with Kim Jong-un in Singapore with North Koreans. But if they were to go down this path, it's difficult for me to see that this would not lead to a military confrontation. Even short of that, let's say the Iranians walk out of the deal and they kick out the inspectors. Right now, Iran is the most inspected country that the IAEA has, spending more time inspecting Iranian facilities than any other country. The headlines would be, Iran kicks out inspectors. I think it would be very difficult not to hear the war drums that would follow those type of headlines. And that's them kicking out the inspectors, that's not them building a weapons. The Israelis don't have the capacity to successfully take out Iran's facilities. They have the capacity of starting something that the U.S. would have to finish. And this was something that the U.S. was very worried about under Obama, because even the military option was not attractive to the Obama administration. But if it were to take place, it would have to take place at a time and a place of America's choosing, not of another country. So if the Israelis started it and the U.S. would be forced to come in and finish it, it would not be under ideal circumstances. I do fear, again, that in the absence of a genuine effort to be able to reach an understanding here, we will be gravitating towards some sort of a conflict. There is a small chance that the Europeans and others will be able to provide the Iranians with enough economic incentives so that they will stay within the deal. But it doesn't look, you have one more question there. It doesn't look particularly likely to succeed, because even if the European companies, governments provide different kinds of guarantees to their companies that we will protect you from US sanctions, these companies at the end of the day are not going to choose to go into the Iranian market and lose access to the American market. That's just not a wise economic decision for them. So are there enough small and medium-sized companies in Europe that don't have any exposure to the United States that would be able to go in and fill in the gap? And it's very difficult to see that that would be able to happen. So it doesn't look particularly good right now, but I think there is a bit of a respite till November. And the reason why I say this is because the appetite for certain countries to push back against the Trump administration's pressure is going to depend, at least to a certain extent, on what happens in the November elections here in the United States. If you have a scenario in which the Democrats take the House and gives an indication that perhaps the Trump administration will end up either being a one-term president, or at a minimum, because the checks and balances of the American system will come back into place with the Democrats controlling at least one chamber, that the Trump administration is not going to be able to do some things, perhaps that will cause these countries to be willing to continue to say no and try to protect the deal. If that doesn't happen, I think the opposite scenario is far more likely.
It's not very cheery. I've been told that I need to close with one last question. And I'll read from what was provided. How do students and young activists gain experience and an opportunity to bridge misunderstandings between the Iranian people that is portrayed in this country? And I'd phrase it the other way around too. How do Iranian students and Iranian activists, the Iranian intelligentsia, that dynamic, well-educated young Iranian slice of Iranian society, how do they help get their country out of their rut? Works both ways.
Oh boy, I'm sure the person who asked this question was hopeful to get a cheerful answer as the last thing. But as you all know, the Supreme Court essentially held up, approved of the Muslim ban yesterday, which then makes the connectivity between the two peoples all the more difficult. We're going to see far less number of Iranian students being able to come to the United States, almost no Iranians outside of those being able to come to the United States. So the people-to-people connections that is so important, in my view, to dispel false views that the Iranians may hold about the United States and false views that the Americans may hold about Iran, which I personally was hoping really would take place after the deal, is probably going to suffer even more now and become even more difficult. That doesn't mean that anyone should give up. It just means that it's going to be a little bit more difficult than in the past. Thankfully, the Iranians are increasingly connected through the internet. The government there has tried to shut down various apps, etc., but they can never truly shut it down because that would shut down the Iranian economy itself. In fact, as one of the things the Rouhani government has done that he had promised is that he's really increased the bandwidth that the Iranians have, the internet bandwidth, as a way of minimizing the hardliners' control on news and the telecommunications. And that has, to a certain extent, succeeded. And there's still ways through in which students can connect with each other online. I hope more and more of that takes place, because as long as there is greater connectivity and a greater sense of understanding each other, I think any decision to go towards a military confrontation will become far more difficult for both sides.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.